Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anwa Deterrent Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lautha, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. The Anwa Deterrent Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowler, and today we're joined by Dr. Rob Kittinger. He and I first met when he was on the staff at Sandia, and I was the director of the School of Advanced Nuclear Deterrent Studies, both at Kirtland Air Force Base. And he's probably one of the most creative and innovative thinkers. He's, you know, moved beyond Sandia, came up with this software that sort of scrubs the dark web and does some really interesting things. And he's doing some, you know, really creative things in the private sector now. And so I always like to talk to Rob about, various topics because he takes a look at it that I hadn't thought of that. So I thought we would come on and have a discussion. You know, we've talked a lot on NucleCast about, you know, the industrial base and where we are on nuclear programs. But I wanted to take a look at a couple of topics we haven't talked about in a while or at all. And so I thought, who better than a creative guy like Rob to join us? So Rob, welcome to NucleCast.
Adam, thanks for having me.
So, you know, the president spoke, he gave his address to, you know, a joint session of Congress. He really didn't talk a lot about nukes, but in his conversation or his talk with the folks at Davos, the World Economic Forum, he sort of dropped a bomb on the crowd about denuclearization. And then, you know, in a White House briefing, he's been really good. The president has done, you know, better than any president in living memory, for me at least, of talking to the press directly frequently. And so, you know, he downloads a lot of information and, you know, in one of those, post-Davos discussions with the press, he mentioned denuclearization with Russia and China. And sometimes, you know, you're not always sure, like, is that his plan or is that sort of a negotiating position where he's going to work a deal, right? Because, you know, President Trump is about making deals. That's sort of his thing. How do we get to a mutually beneficial deal? And so we've seen a lot of discussion about denuclearization, or at least a couple times. And then people, you know, in D.C. and in the nuclear enterprise are left like, you know, sort of stunned because in his first administration, we got, you know, W-76 Mod 2 and we got Slick 'em In. And then now you're sort of like, is this consistent? And what's the president trying to do? And so with that sort of backdrop in mind, there were a couple of topics you and I wanted to discuss in terms of tritium production and the need for, you know, dedicated production. And, you know, so let's just go ahead and start there. And this is something, you know, that you've been advocating. And I think, fill me in on sort of where we are. I know that, you know, we're working with uranium enrichment up at Y-12. This is sort of something they're getting, you know, behind. And, you know, the folks, in South Carolina at Savannah River, you know, tritium is sort of their thing. So where do we stand and what are we doing?
Yeah. Most of the listeners probably know, but tritium and deuterium are kind of the hydrogen that makes a hydrogen bomb work. You've got nuclear fission where you're breaking things apart, you know, typically uranium, plutonium, you split those atoms and you get a lot of energy in return. The alternative to that or kind of in conjunction with that is, of course, fusion, where you're jamming together and fusing small things. So when you're fissioning things, they're at the bottom of the periodic table, big, heavy elements that you're breaking apart. When you're fusing things, you're doing that at the very top. So hydrogen is the lightest element. So that's the thing that fuses easiest. And typically it's creating helium when you do fuse it, and that releases even more energy than fission. And so that is the tritium that we're talking about, or, you know, the hydrogen isotope that we're talking about. And you're right, that's happening down at Savannah River site is where they're kind of dealing with those types of components in the nuclear weapon systems. And of course, as you mentioned, Y-12 is doing the uranium, kind of famously, originally with the Calutrons and the racetrack up there, kind of separating the uranium. So really cool background. I appreciated your intro. And just to kind of lay, I guess, to level set, I'm pro-NATO. I am pro, allies. I am a big supporter of everything that NATO has done and is doing. I've even supported their operations, as recently as 2020. That is something that's very close to my heart, number one. So I'll kind of set that boundary first. And then second, I would just say that I am a member, a former member of the nuclear weapons complex. I come out of 10 years at Sandia National Laboratories. Proudly a 2017 weapon intern graduate. That's kind of the background. I love the nuclear weapons complex. I'm very pro deterrence. I believe in the power of deterrence. And so typically, nuclear deterrence, as you mentioned, and Trump's kind of background is kind of in contrast to that deterrence policy and standpoint. So we can talk about that in a second, but speaking specifically to tritium and why kind of we're bringing that up, tritium is, it has a half-life. And so, it's going to go away every so many years, right? And I don't know off the top of my head, but I believe it's somewhere around 13 years half-life. And so that means that it's one of these limited life components within nuclear weapons. And, it's something that has to be changed out or updated as time goes on. So I won't go into exact timing schedules and things like that for this podcast. But because it's a limited life component element, we have to get that from somewhere. So we need tritium supply. And it is one of the most expensive elements on Earth if you buy it by the gram. I think it's like $30,000 per gram. It's probably more than that. And so we need a dedicated supply chain for this. The only way to get it is out of nuclear reactors. And there's only certain types of nuclear reactors that are kind of good at producing it. Like the CANDU reactors are, I believe, some of the best. So, Canada has a lot of these CANDU reactors. They have a lot of tritium on their hands. They're not going to give it to us because they won't give us anything that goes into a weapon. And so we don't have tritium coming from them. And it's too expensive, and it's not the business model of U.S., power plants, nuclear power plants, to sell tritium. That's not what they're doing. They're selling power to the grid, to consumers. And so we really need a military dedicated nuclear reactor as part of our dedicated supply chain, our trusted supply chain that we kind of control, and it's purpose built for that reason. So that's kind of the idea of a dedicated nuclear reactor to ensure a tritium supply for our systems.
And as I understand it from conversations, with NucleCast guests, it's not something we have an abundance of anymore. We used to produce a lot. That production, that supply has gone way down. Our arsenal's more than 90% smaller than it used to be. So the supply of tritium has also gone way down, but this is beginning to be a problem for, whatever arsenal we have in the future. And if our arsenal expands, as, at the end of the Biden administration, you had Vipin Narang and Pranay Vaddi, both, sort of in the, senior nuclear positions in the administration, said, hey, we may have to actually expand because of what's going on in the world. And so if the president isn't able to work a deal, then, you know, that may be the position. We may need more tritium than we currently produce. So this sort of goes back to your original point of the idea that we need a dedicated supply. We need the kind of reactor that produces it. So that, you know, that's, you know, an important thing. And I don't know how, you know, for NucleCast NucleCast listeners who are deeply embedded and, you know, really understand, you know, the nuclear enterprise from end to end, they're like, oh yeah, that's old hat. But if it's not something that, you know, you think about a lot, you know, you may think, oh geez, I hadn't really thought about tritium production that much. You know, I'd sort of think about, you know, for the policy wonks who don't think about all the components of a weapon and what goes into it. So besides tritium, are there other sort of key things that you see that we need to be thinking about, need to be working on? I mean, you know, we've talked about Nunn-McCurdy and we've talked about the challenges with, you know, with Sentinel. You know, there are challenges and there very well may be a what is equivalent to a Nunn-McCurdy with Columbia. And but what other sort of those things that we don't often think about or talk about are you sort of thinking, ah, this is something that needs to be on our radar?
Yeah, I guess, you know, my mind goes to potentially using small modular reactors on these forward operating bases in Afghanistan and other places. That kind of comes from thinking about the number of people who die because they're in these diesel fuel supply chain. So they're trucking all this diesel out to these forward operating bases in Afghanistan and other places. And it is a soft target, these supply chains are, where people can set up roadside IEDs and attack these trucks. And, you know, I was looking at some articles, and so back in 2015, an article came out saying that in 13 years, there had been 120 deaths of just the drivers of these diesel supply chains. So, you know, that's 9+ soldiers per year that we were losing to these IED attacks. And so one way to prevent that is, you know, just put a small modular reactor on each of these bases. You get about 300 kilowatts out of each one, and it's going to be there for years. You don't have to worry about all the costs. It's not even the fuel cost. It's saving lives and it's saving fuel cost. And you're set for years and years and years with basically unlimited energy to power those bases. Now, at the same time, you know, we here at NucleCast have to be worried about proliferation risks of having small modular reactors, you know, in Afghanistan. And so you do have to make that a hardened target. There's some additional cost there to shoring it up and making sure that it's securely there. And so that's another kind of element to it.
Yeah, so I want to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll continue to delve into this, because we've actually had a couple of guests on from the, you know, that are talking about Gen 3 and Gen 4 reactors in the past. So for those listeners, make sure you go back and sort of do a keyword search for our podcast on that topic. But you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back. Okay, so you, Rob, you mentioned this need for FOBs. And so it's funny you bring this up, because we have had a couple of past podcasts on this, probably at least a year ago or so. And, you know, it was interesting because I hadn't really thought about it. I'm, you know, I know weapons, but not power as much. But so, you know, in our discussions, it was like, hey, these things are the size of like a cargo container. And you burn them up and you cover them, and you can sort of, you know, for a FOB, you can, you know, make them to where they're protected, and then they'll produce sufficient power for that FOB. I mean, they're not going to provide the diesel fuel you might need for your MRAPs or Humvees or whatever. So you'll have to have that, but they'll give you the power you need to run that fob that could have, you know, thousands of soldiers, airmen, you know, so that's a significant fuel requirement right now. And that they're, you know, and then if they are struck, because I was like, well, hey, what if they get struck? Well, they shut down on their own because they're, you know, that's sort of the way that like third and fourth gen reactors, instead of, you know, most reactors are first and second generation, and the technology, and, you know, this is, we should probably bring on somebody from Idaho National Labs to talk about where we are with reactors, but it's just worlds apart. You know, it's not, you know, Cuba driving 1950 Chevys anymore. It's, you know, it's Teslas and things of that nature. It's just a totally different world. And the military ramifications are quite striking. You know, I haven't heard this from President Trump. He's talked about unleashing, you know, energy in the U.S. And, you know, it's drill, baby, drill. I think he said that in his speech to, you know, to Congress. But I haven't heard a lot about just sort of opening the gates for nuclear power. And, you know, one of the things we actually had a podcast on this, on uranium enrichment. And I didn't realize how civil nuclear energy and weapons are tied together because of similar components and aspects of it, that they're not like completely separate. So can you talk maybe about some of the relationships and how you see, you know, things working in conjunction?
Yeah. So to your point, they're not entirely separate, right? So previously, you know, Hanford Reactor was a source of plutonium for us. So it was a reactor. It was generating plutonium. That plutonium was able to be put into nuclear weapons. Now, that was in the past. We have an abundance of plutonium from old weapon systems that we can kind of reuse and recycle. And so that's not a critical need at the moment for us. But that is one way that these nuclear reactors are not separated entirely from the weapons. And that's important to kind of understand as a concept, because in other countries, their reactors are actively pushing plutonium into their nuclear weapons.
Yeah, systems. They're breeding.
They're breeding plutonium.
Yeah, I mean, it's how we understand, you know, Chris Yaw and John Swiegel and Dave Rabine wrote a great article in the CWMD Journal where they looked at the studies that have been done looking at how much plutonium the Chinese have likely, you know, bred in their reactors. And then, therefore, that's how you try to, you know, guess how many weapons, you know, based on how many pounds of plutonium, how many pounds they've done, you know, bred total, therefore how many warheads or pits can you make. You know, it's kind of a important tie, so it sort of goes back to your point. So I digressed.
Yeah,
I'll let you
know. It's an important thing. You know, I come out of the kind of counterterrorism, counterproliferation world. And so that is, you know, close to my heart, everything you're saying. And so, yeah, it is this fuel cycle, right, where, you know, you start with uranium in the ground, you know, it goes into a nuclear power plant after it's refined, and then you can breed it into plutonium. And, you know, I'm massively oversimplifying it, but
sure.
You know, there is this whole nuclear fuel cycle that kind of makes nuclear weapon systems components. And so, should we talk a little bit about Trump denuclearizing and that whole concept?
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, because this is a big topic in the nuclear enterprise that everybody's like, well, hey, what's going to happen now and how will this impact me? So yeah. I'll give you the first go at it.
Thanks. So I'm just gonna say up front, I reserve the right to change my mind in 10 minutes. So, you know, take this with a grain of sand. But, you know, here's the interesting thing. You know, prior to his presidency, Obama was very, he wanted to be a nuclear-free policy. He wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons. That was one of the things he had kind of talked about. That was his dream. Obama was in a very different world than Trump is in. He's a very different president than Trump is. And so, you know, when Obama moved into office, we then see the shift that took place. You know, he went, he had the conversations at the Pentagon. He had the conversations at Stratcom. He understood after, you know, a few, and I don't want to sound demeaning to him in any ways, but he was educated on the topic. And I just, I mean that very honestly. And so in that education process, he came to realize how important nuclear deterrence is. And so he then gives the Prague speech. And we hear Obama saying, and I've got the quote pulled up, "Make no mistake, as long as these weapons exist, the United States will maintain a safe, secure, and effective arsenal to deter any adversary and guarantee the defense to our allies, including the Czech Republic, but we will begin the work of reducing our arsenal." So that's his famous Prague speech by Obama. And so we see that shift from nuclear-free policy to we're going to maintain a safe, credible deterrent as long as necessary. So what do I think about the current Trump situation? Because I am very surprised. You know, I was at Sandia Labs when his first nuclear posture review came out, and it did kind of open the gateway for several new weapon systems to kind of come out that you listed earlier. And so when we see this and it shifts to denuclearize, it's interesting, right? So for context and kind of setting the stage, you know, previously under the Obama administration and Biden, we saw, you know, close ties with Europe, close ties with NATO, close ties with Ukraine. And then we had on the other side, you know, Warsaw Pact nations, as well as China, you know, China, Russia kind of on one side. And so what we see now, though, is that Trump has kind of changed the field. And I know that everyone's upset about his comments about Ukraine here recently. But what's interesting about it is he's changed. He's shifted the United States politically to the middle of the world at the moment. So we've got our three generations of good relationships with the allies, with Europe, with NATO countries. And then we have moved under Trump closer to where China and Russia are. Now, that creates a really interesting perspective because we're politically in a better landscape to make a global deal. If we want to move towards global peace, we can reach back to our allies and be friendly with our old friends again. But we're also kind of, we've got the ear, I would say, of Russia and China, and they're ready to kind of listen to, okay, it's a more favorable environment to us. What does he have to say? And so I do think that there is a greater potential for some kind of multi-phase, you know, 7 to 10 year kind of plan to move towards nuclear denuclearization, rather, globally, where there's a lot of verification and we start, you know, staging down. Why, you know, what implications does that have for deterrence in general? Because it has preserved peace, in my opinion, of preventing massive wars, like we saw in World War II, where 26.6 million Russians died. That hasn't happened since then. And we haven't seen Russia use nukes in Ukraine, even though they've been kind of weapon desperate. And so the only thing I would say is, you know, I think that we're in a good place to look at denuclearization. I also think that the global economy is different, where we can maybe talk about, instead of nuclear nuclear deterrence, economic deterrence, where we create some kind of posture where you get cut off from world trade if you break the deal.
Yeah, my only challenge to this, and then I'll give you a chance to, you know, to bring Bob out and let Bob the genie grant your wishes. But my only challenge is that I don't ever want a world free of nuclear weapons. I never want that world because I know what that world looks like.
Yeah.
It looks like 100 million dead in World War II and the rise, oh, by the way, the rise of communist China because of World War II. And then they killed 50 million more of their own people. And now we're considering and contemplating a war with communist China. And then before that, World War I, which ultimately led to the rise of the Soviet Union, who we spent 50 years trying to, you know, deter. And, you know, we can go back for generation after generation and look at these wars where you've got, you know, half of Europe is wiped out, or, you know, wars where, you know, the Mongols moved west and killed millions, or, I mean, when, you know, the Arab conquest of, you know, Christian North Africa, millions died. And so I've seen great power wars happen over and over and over and over. And it always means millions die. And so I just don't know that I ever want to go back to that world again. Because that's what you do. You make the world safe for great power wars again when you get rid of nukes. And so I'm not sure I want that world.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. You know, I am a nuclear deterrence proponent. I believe in the power of it. I believe that it has prevented all of these wars in the past. And, you know, I kind of feel like it's a wait and see what the deal is and what is the proposal to have something that is just as deterrent as nuclear weapons, if that power exists. And what could it be replaced with? I'm not saying it should be, but and I will just maybe finish on just saying I don't want to ever see nuclear weapons go away either. And I think one reason we will never see them go away is we're realizing more and more that we need them for planetary defense purposes. We need if we see an asteroid coming and it's, you know, 5 years away, we need to meet it halfway and just knock it off a quarter of a degree, so that over the next several years, it misses our planet. And so, you know, I think we definitely need a few large kiloton weapons, maybe megaton weapons, to do that. And then I think having that nuclear deterrence has been a very stabilizing force for numerous generations now. So,
yeah,
you won't hear me go against that.
Well, we could just give a few to the United Nations for planetary defense. What could go wrong? And then we'll be fine. Okay. All right. So let's switch to Bob the Genie because we're getting late in the show. So Bob the Genie comes back, rub my magic lamp. Bob, of course, grants all guests 3 wishes, but they got to be related to the topics of discussion. So Rob Kittinger, what is your first wish?
Oh, my goodness. I've got to go with... I've got to go with the dedicated nuclear reactor. You know, I think having a military dedicated nuclear reactor, it's DOD owned and operated. It supplies, you know, power. And then it also supplies our necessary hydrogen isotopes.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to have that. I mean, boost gas is important. So, all right. Okay. Number two.
Second wish. You know, I guess I'm going to have to go with putting out the small modular reactors. I think that this is going to save lives. I think it provides the power necessary for next generation military activities like laser-based defenses against, you know, drone swarms and all the things that are facing us in the future. Yeah, so I guess that's number two, small modular reactors.
And there's so many more uses for them, too.
There's so many. You know,
civilian uses. All right, and final wish.
Yeah, I mean, can we say world peace?
World peace. I mean, that's a great one for Miss America, but I'm going to hold you to a higher standard.
I mean, I'm looking kind of Miss America-like. No, let's see. You inspired this one, Adam. I'm going to go with diversifying our sea-based leg of the triad. And I'm going to go with kind of putting nuclear warheads on more ships than just submarines.
Yeah, I joined the Navy when, you know, about the time they were pulling them off out of the surface fleet. So, you know, I'm a big fan that, you have diversity that, you know, with submarines. And, you know, the Chinese have said, hey, we can, you know, because of their magnetic signature, we can now track your subs. So let's suppose, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but let's suppose quantum computing, magnetic signatures, eventually submarines won't, you know, the oceans won't be as opaque as they are.
Right.
And so therefore, do you want to put all your eggs in that one basket? And I'm not sure the answer is yes.
Yeah, it helps, you know, it makes it easier to do a shell game and just make it less predictable where you're at. And I think that's of big value.
All right, Rob Kittinger, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.